Last week, I had some guys with a truck come over to my house to pump out my septic tank. I don't have sewer. I have a septic tank in my backyard under the ground. It's lovely. All my crap is sitting right next to my house, just waiting for me to suck it up. So these guys come over. They charge me a couple of $100, and they suck out all my crap from my septic tank. And me being me, it was cathartic. Ron, how can that be cathartic, having guys come over and suck it? First of all, I felt for these guys. Their job every day is to go to people's houses and suck up crap through a hose into their truck, and then they drive around. What an awful job that probably is. They look like they're doing well financially, although to look at them with crap all over their boots, sucking up, it's just not. You know, what do you say on a first date? What do you do for a living? You work Wall Street? You own a business? No, I suck up crap through a tube from people's houses and then I drive around with it.
Oh, I'm a little busy Friday, so no.
You know, you can't just work and then go right out on a date. You got to go home and shower, I figure, and change your clothes. At least put on some new boots. But I had a cathartic experience because I am who I am. Nothing happens on surface level. Everything happens underneath it. Everything has a meaning and a deeper purpose. I said to myself, look at these guys sucking up crap and cleaning out my tank. I should do that. Not that I should put on boots and suck out crap from a tank, but I should empty the crap from my own life. And that life would be my tank. Or my tank would be my life. One way or the other, I think you know what I'm talking about. Why don't I suck it up? Is not everything in this world analogous to me? I walk around every day with a tank of crap in my body. No, that's not what I mean. Mental crap. With no hose connected to rid myself of this horrible septic mess. See, every once in a while in our lives, we should stop, hook up a hose to our heads, and suck out the crap, and let somebody else drive around with it. Start anew, with your mind empty and clean and fresh. Get that psychological hose and hook it up. Well, how do we do that? Do I really find a psychological hose at Walmart? No, they don't sell it there. It's got to be your hose, and you have to do the sucking. Oh, you suck well, but you have to suck in order to get the crap out of your head. How do we do that? Through meditation? Through yoga? Through yogurt? Well, I don't know. I think that's different for everybody. I think the realization of just sitting in a chair and saying to yourself, I'm cleaning myself out. We do physical colonics on our body. Why not do it on our minds? If I can do one thing in my life, it would be to suck out the crap from my brain.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
It would be like Jaws.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show.
Yeah.
Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird. If you like that sort of thing.
It would be like Jaws, where they say, we got to get a bigger hose.
Whatever.
Yeah, they would say that. Got to get a bigger hose.
Good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Very nice, very nice.
Back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, whatever your liquid libation may be in the morning, and join us as we take a look at the world around us. As much as it's a pleasure to be with you, the pleasure is actually all yours. And now, here's your host, Ron Van Dam.
Thank you very much, Julie. Hey, welcome to the program. How are you today? Good fun. A couple of weeks ago, I went to the Museum of Fine Arts in downtown Boston. And some incredible paintings, which I really don't care about. I'm not really into paintings. I'm very unsophisticated in that sense. I'm very cultural, but very unsophisticated as far as paintings are concerned. To me, the paintings that are incredible are the ones that look like they're actual photographs, but they're actually painted. That, to me, is just a technical aspect of it, and that's really all I can appreciate. Although, in the back of my mind, I'm saying, wow, you have to look at how things are framed and the vision and the meaning behind it and what was going on in the artist's mind. And as I look at a painting and try to consider all of that, I say to myself, well, I really don't care. So paintings and myself don't really get along too well. I'm amazed when somebody that I know paints something very well, because that's an achievement. But when an established artist does a nice painting, I say to myself, you're an artist. What am I supposed to do here? I mean, you are a painter. You are an artist. You've done a artistic picture. What do you want me to do with that? Again, when a five-year-old child paints something that is absolutely incredible, that to me is amazing. When a guy that makes billions of dollars selling his or her paintings does a nice painting, I say to myself, you're doing your job well. I mean, you're just doing what you do, right? What's the deal here? You know what I'm saying? Anyway, so I go to this museum and I'm walking around looking at the paintings, half interested. But again, my mind goes deeper than what's actually in front of my head. And out of the corner of my eye, there's a little thing going on. There's a man standing there. He is a museum guard. He's dressed in a suit. He's got a dark jacket and a red tie on. And I watch him. And he does nothing at all. Period. His job is to do nothing at all, period. Apparently, he's not supposed to speak to the museum goers because no one has conversation with this guy. He doesn't approach them and say, hi, enjoying the paintings? Nothing like that. People don't go up to him except ask where the bathroom is, but there are signs all over the place, so you don't even have to do that. The guy does absolutely nothing. He'll pace back and forth a little bit, and then he'll go back to the spot he was standing in previously, and he does nothing. His job is to do nothing. Make sure that nothing happens, and as that progresses successfully, do nothing. Just stand there, keep your eyes open, shut up, and do nothing. You cannot sit down. You must stand there and do nothing. for 6 to 8 hours. This has got to be the worst job ever. I also assume it doesn't pay that well. This guy is not living in a mansion. He's living in a rundown apartment somewhere where there is no hot water, no air conditioning, and he's just waiting for the next day when he can put on his jacket and tie, go to the museum, and do absolutely nothing. They don't even ask him, they don't even give him a broom and a dustpan. He is not to do that. That's the job of the custodian. His job is to do nothing. At all. Nothing. Do not sit. Do not talk. Do nothing. Even if you pace, how can you even justify your existence? He's looking at the same paintings for hours and hours and hours and hours. At this point, he must hate art. Not only the art hanging on the wall, but the guy in the next room who hired him, and his name is Art. I don't know how this man could even have a painting in his house. He must be sick of paintings.
I can't go to a restaurant if there's a painting on the wall. I look at paintings 8 hours a day, and I do nothing.
What a job this would be. Does this make you an introvert or an extrovert when you're not working in the museum? The second you get out of the museum, do you talk up a storm because you haven't said anything in 8 hours at all? You've done nothing? Or are you indeed an introvert, and only introverts could have jobs like this, where they don't talk at all, they're just deaf mutes? Would you go to a museum, stand around for 8 hours a day, do nothing at all, just do nothing, and then go home and sit down on a couch and do nothing? Do you stand in the corner of your room and pace because that's what you do professionally? What happens at a cocktail party?
What do you do for a job, Joe?
I'm a guard at the museum. Ooh, are you guarding crown jewels?
No, no. I just walk around a room where some people have paintings. I don't even know who they are.
Can you perform a little bit of your job for me so I can see what you do?
I'm doing it. I'm just standing here. That's all I do. I went to college for 4 years to learn how to just to stand and went in a corner all day. 4 years of college down the drain. I could have gone to a technical school to learn that. I actually, be honest with you, I've been standing around all my life. I do this very well.
Wow, good to see you. Friday, I can't make it Friday, sorry. This is what the guys who empty the septic tanks and the guys who stand in a museum and do nothing have in common. They don't date on Fridays.
I'm busy, I'm sorry. You
sound interesting, but no. I'm not, sorry, no, not going to happen. I'm not interested. Oh! All right, maybe I'm putting them down. Maybe all of our jobs are just boring. Anything you do hour after hour, day after day, year after year, has got to get boring eventually. What if you were a nymphomaniac? All you want to do is have sex all day. At a point, that's got to become really boring. I don't know. I don't know if I want to have sex on Friday with you. I do this every day, all day. I mean, seriously. What do prostitutes do? What do they do when they meet somebody? You pretty much just do it for no charge, I guess. You throw them a freebie. If you do it professionally. I've always wondered about that. And excuse me for my ignorance and my whatever I am. But I was wondering how a gynecologist actually gets through the day. And I know it's not a real sexual job because it's different to have sex with somebody or at least to satisfy them, than it is to probe a woman in a gynecological exam. However, would this make you really good in bed, or would it make you lethargic?
If I see another one of these vaginas, I'm going to go crazy. Enough with the vaginas already. God, what is it like that they all have them? Enough with it. Put it back in your clothes and leave me alone.
Or is it, I clinically look at them all day. Just give me one to have a good time with. I don't know which one it is. By the way, I hope the kids left the room during that little ditty. I don't know which it is, but I wouldn't want to find out. Would I like to be a gynecologist? No. No, I would not. Because there's going to come the point in my career that I'm going to get pissed at something.
I don't want to look at another one of these things. That would be me. I don't want to look at another one of these things again. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't. You're a lovely woman. I think I have feelings for you, but you got to put that thing away. I can't do this anymore. If I see, come on. If I had a dollar for every one I do. I do have a dollar for every one I've seen. So actually that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. Oh, the world's a mess. That's why I need to suck out my brain in a septic manner. Did I show you a picture of my puppy dog?
Aww.
Look at my puppy dog drinking out of the water dish.
Aww.
Here's my puppy dog taking a crap on my lawn.
Aww.
Here's my puppy dog turning around to smell what it just crapped.
Aww.
Here's my puppy dog taking a lick of that.
Aww.
Here's me showing you why I don't have a real job.
Aww.
Okay. I have definitely gotten enough pity out of you, I have a feeling.
Do you know that there is one item that can not only increase your home's beauty, but its value? That would be placemats. Hello, I'm George Karanapikopoulos, owner of George K's Wholesale Placemat Warehouse, your one stop for all your placemat needs. We have a placemat for every room of your house. That's right, placemats are not just for the dining room anymore. Anywhere you might make a spill, or maybe where you eat, like in front of the TV, I do it all the time like you. You want a placemat. We have fancy placemats, like in bamboo or teak. That's right, teak. Nice plastic laminate ones for no stains, even blue. We can custom make you placemats in as little as 2 weeks. Come to our showroom at the intersection of Route 27 and the Holbrook Turnpike. You're going to like what you see. Your placemat is waiting for you at George K's Wholesale Placemat Warehouse.
Not a bad place, actually. I get lost in there. Once I see a couple of nice placemats, I am mesmerized for hours and hours and hours and hours. Like a museum guard, in a way. My guest coming up rather soon is going to talk about suicide prevention, and I'll tell you something, that's so much in the news. It has to do with depression and sucky life things going on, and it's a disease. It's not just someone walking around saying, I'm bored, I've had it, my life is done. It's rarely that. It is a disease. It's a chemical imbalance that makes you look at things in a very different way, and it becomes very psychologically painful to the point where you don't even know what you're doing anymore. That's my assessment of it, even though I'm not a doctor, but I thought we would talk to one and talk about suicide prevention. With the recent suicide of Anthony Bourdain, this subject matter comes up again. As it did years ago with the suicide of Robin Williams. When someone very popular takes their life, I guess that's the right phrase, I don't really know, it becomes discussion again. And all of a sudden we say, well, I know people like this, and now I'm very concerned about them. It's amazing how we gather together and we talk about things when they happen, and then a few weeks later, it's like, man, whatever. You know, our attention span in this country is so freaking short, it's unbelievable. And I think especially the Trump administration kind of banks on that. Like, no matter what he does, you'll forget about it in a few days. And you'll say, how can I forget about that? Because he brings up something else and you go to that. The man's like a magician of psychology. He's a stupid asshole, but he's still a magician of psychology. But he's not that smart. It's that we're that dumb. That's all it is. We are that dumb. And you might say, Ron, are you calling me dumb? Yeah. Because no one in this country is standing up to anything anymore. We have been dumbed down. We have become comfortably numb. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. Seriously.
Just not if you can hear me. Is there anyone home? Come on down. I hear you breathing down. Well, I can ease your pain, get you on your feet again.
Eesh, really? Become comfortably numb. Let's stop doing that and start being uncomfortable with what's going on instead of being comfortably numb to it. Let's talk about suicide prevention. Dr. Christy Mutia joins us. She's Chief Medical Officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Ron, for having me on.
Pleasure. You know, every once in a while, of course, we always hear about suicide and suicide prevention, and every once in a while, one occurs on a celebrity national level, sometimes international level, and all of a sudden, we're reminded about just how mysterious this really is. When you least expect it, you find that quite popular people have performed this undetectable act to the public, and then we're reminded of the hotline numbers and such. I guess every once in a while it takes a tragedy to be able to make a point.
Yes, I think like so many conditions that we've almost grown immune and accustomed mm-hmm. to, and you know, we can't pay attention to everything at all times, but certainly of late, many really important social issues, and in this case, suicide being a complicated but health-related issue, when they gain that national attention and dialogue, mm-hmm. then things can change. And we believe that it may be the time for that because, you know, like you're pointing out, it's not what it may seem on the outside.
Right.
But no matter what you're standing in life, we're all very human at the core, and that means having the usual susceptibilities to changes in mental health and perception and the way that stress affects us.
Well, it's like a popular, successful celebrity contracting a disease. It has really nothing to do with your standing in life. It has more to do with something that's going wrong in your chemistry.
That's right. And I think you're getting at that sort of assumption that people have had for so long that if you are successful mm-hmm. and if you have happiness, or at least you look like you do mm-hmm. from the outside, that that suicide, depression, addiction, PTSD must not be a part of that mm-hmm. person's life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case at all. If anything, it's simply now we're realizing that so many people who experience changes in mental health actually go to great lengths to kind of keep it under wraps.
Sure.
And, you know, that's a personal choice, certainly, to keep any health issue, you know, to yourself mm-hmm. and private. But to the extent that stigma has played a role in keeping mental health experiences and mental health conditions especially secret and hidden
yes.
in families and so forth, there's just no reason for that. We understand these are real health issues that nobody chooses and nobody brings on unto their own. They're things like heart disease and diabetes that have a complicated mixture of
right.
genetic drivers and other factors that play in,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm. So obviously increasing public awareness, certainly when tragedies occur, that is achieved. But then, like everything else, the impact goes away, and we go back to our normal lives, and we go right back to where we were. I think that's our problem in humanity and
yeah.
society. We always forget the impact of something when time passes, which is not too cool.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, go on.
Well, yes, I mean, I think you're so right. We have very short attention
yes.
spans in general. But I will say, when there's a sort of a growing foundation, if you will, of learning, understanding, becoming more aware that these are tragedies
mm-hmm.
that we can actually do something about, and then, of course, for people who are personally affected, either through a loss to suicide or because you have a loved one who has a mental health condition or has had a suicide attempt or you yourself have had those experiences, then you're poised to have each time those events happen in the national space to really strike a chord, and some people will be galvanized into action. And what I would say is it feels to me like we are potentially reaching that kind of tipping point in our nation. It just so happens coincidentally that our volunteers from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention this very day, today, this was scheduled long ago, so
mm-hmm.
it is coincidental, but every year they make Hill visits, and they visit 100 Senate offices and 430 House offices, all those congressional staffers and members, and this may be a time where there's a readiness to listen. Of course, we have advocates on the Hill already for mental health and suicide prevention,
mm-hmm.
but we need more. We have not invested at the federal level in the research and programs and treatment like we have for those other
mm-hmm.
leading health issues and leading causes of death.
I guess it's very difficult to tell the difference between depression and clinical depression. I know that since the last election, I've seen a lot of depressed people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, I think you have to learn how to read the difference, I guess. Is that what we're saying?
Well, what I would say is everyone has mental health. So
yes.
we all have, our moods change,
sure.
right? We can be impacted by, like you say, the environment,
mm-hmm.
Things going on at work,
mm-hmm.
in our home, financial stress, relationship stress. All of that can impact us and our mental health. But there are a large number of Americans, it's one in four actually
mm-hmm.
currently, and even more than that from a lifetime prevalence standpoint, who will actually experience a diagnosable mental health condition, 1 in 4 right now. And the majority of those individuals don't realize, as you're pointing out, that it has actually crossed over a line from kind of normal ways of experiencing stress to the mental health condition like depression or an anxiety disorder actually driving your decisions, your perceptions, feelings, mood, sleep, appetite. Those are some of the ways, and it is hard from the inside because it's hard to be objective ourselves. But if you're the loved one observing these kind of changes in your spouse or in your family members, even friends and larger community, even at work, it's a conversation that I would encourage all of us that we can have, just like we would if you noticed that somebody's physical health were ailing. You wouldn't just be standoffish and say, well, I don't want to offend the person, so I'm not going to kind of express support and
that's
care.
Right. That's right.
You know, we should approach it in the exact same way that we do with physical health.
Well, the one thing that I think that we've gotten beyond in this decade is the term crazy. Because that used to be attached, and that was extremely negative, extremely embarrassing. But now that word is kind of gone, and it's transposed into a mental illness that one is not really responsible for. So that's a step forward, I guess, even in that sense. What do we do if we do know somebody that has crossed that line? I guess we talk to them, and there are plenty of suicide prevention hotlines. I see them posted all the time.
Yes, most definitely. And if I could actually just go back to your earlier point about the change in our language and our lexicon, because I think this is a really important point you're making that indicates that the culture is shifting in a way that is becoming more informed about mental health, about mental illness, and about suicide. And so there are a couple of key changes in language that the suicide prevention field and people who have been touched by suicide in any way strongly advocate for. And so just a couple of them. One is to stop using the phrase commit suicide, because that comes from a time when we didn't have science showing that suicide is a complicated but health-related outcome or experience of suicidal ideation, suicidal thinking. And so we encourage the phrase, just plain language, died by suicide, took his or her life, ended his or her life.
Right.
And similarly, we avoid things like a failed or a completed or successful suicide attempt. Because if you're using the phrase suicide attempt, it implies that they lived. And that they survived that attempt.
Yes.
So those are a couple of the changes in language that we really strongly recommend.
Very good point.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, the organization is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and you can visit them at afsp.org to get more information and to get a little bit deeper into any questions and answers you may have. That's afsp.org. And again, there's always a multitude of suicide prevention hotlines and your mental health experts through your health insurance, whatever the case may be. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for highlighting this important issue.
Okay, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It is important, my friends. Yes, it is. We're out of time for today. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new show. Until then, I do wish you peace.